Chapter 2. So it seems, my dear birdies, apostrophe is it, young man? Eat, dear birdies, apostrophe indeed. I'll tickle your breeches, and see if you say, eat, dear birdies, apostrophe again in a hurry. And you've been idling at the schoolmaster's too, instead of coming here, handy, hey? That's how you earn your sixpence a day for keeping the rooks off my corn. Whilst saluting Jude's ears with this impassioned rhetoric, Trotham had seized his left hand with his own left, and swinging his slim frame round him at arm's length, again struck Jude on the hind parts with the flat side of Jude's own rattle, till the field echoed with the blows, which were delivered once or twice at each revolution. Don't eat, sir, please don't eat, cried the whirling child, as helpless under the centrifugal tendency of his person as a hooked fish swinging to land, and beholding the hill, the rick, the plantation, the path, and the rooks going round, and round him in an amazing circular race. I sir only meant, that there was a good crop in the ground I saw him sow it, and the rooks could have a little bit for dinner and you wouldn't miss it, sir, and Mr. Phillotson said I was to be kind to him, oh. This truthful explanation seemed to exasperate the farmer even more than if Jude had stoutly denied saying anything at all, and he still smacked the whirling urchin, the clacks of the instrument continuing to resound all across the field, and as far as the ears of distant workers who gathered thereupon that Jude was pursuing his business of clacking with great assiduity and echoing from the brand new church tower just behind the mist, towards the building of which structure the farmer had largely subscribed, to testify his love for God and man. Presently Trotham grew tired of his punitive task, and depositing the quivering boy on his legs, took a sixpence from his pocket, and gave it him in payment for his day's work, telling him to go home, and never let him see him in one of those fields again. Jude leaped out of arm's reach, and walked along the trackway weeping not from the pain, though that was keen enough, not from the perception of the flaw in the terrestrial scheme, by which what was good for God's birds was bad for God's gardener, but with the awful sense that he had wholly disgraced himself before he had been a year in the parish, and hence might be a burden to his great aunt for life. With this shadow on his mind he did not care to show himself in the village, and went homeward by a roundabout track behind a high hedge, and across a pasture. Here he beheld scores of coupled earthworms lying half their length on the surface of the damp ground, as they always did in such weather at that time of the year. It was impossible to advance in regular steps without crushing some of them at each tread. Though Farmer Trotham had just hurt him, he was a boy who could not himself bear to hurt anything. He had never brought home a nest of young birds without lying awake in misery half the night after, and often reinstating them, and the nest in their original place the next morning. He could scarcely bear to see trees cut down or lopped, from a fancy that it hurt them, and late pruning, when the sap was up and the tree bled profusely, had been a positive grief to him in his infancy. This weakness of character, as it may be called, suggested that he was the sort of man who was born to ache a good deal before the fall of the curtain upon his unnecessary life should signify that all was well with him again. He carefully picked his way on tiptoe among the earthworms, without killing a single one. On entering the cottage he found his aunt selling a penny loaf to a little girl, and when the customer was gone she said, "Well, how do you come to be back here in the middle of the morning like this? I'm turned away." "What? Mr. Trotham have turned me away, because I let the rooks have a few peckings of corn. And there's my wages the last I shall ever pay." He threw the sixpence tragically on the table. "Ah," said his aunt, suspending her breath. And she opened upon him a lecture on how she would now have him all the spring upon her hands doing nothing. "If you can't skeer birds, what can he do? There! Don't he look so deedy? Farmer Trotham is not so much better than myself, come to that. But 'tis as Job said, 'Now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock.' apostrophe apostrophe his father was my father's journeyman, anyhow, and I must have been a fool to let E go to work for N, which I shouldn't have done, but to keep E out of Mishti. More angry with Jute for demeaning her by coming there than for dereliction of duty, she rated him primarily from that point of view, and only secondarily from a moral one. Not that you should have let the birds eat what Farmer Trotham planted. Of course he was wrong in that. Jude, why didst go off with that schoolmaster of thine to Christminster or somewhere? But, oh no, poor ornery child, there never was any sprawl on thy side of the family, and never will be. Where is this beautiful city, and this place where Mr. Phillotson is gone to? Asked the boy, after meditating in silence. Lord, you ought to know where the city of Christminster is. Near a score of miles from here. It is a place much too good for you ever to have much to do with. Poor boy, I'm a thinking. And will Mr. Phillotson always be there? How can I tell? Could I go to see him? Lord, no. You didn't grow up hereabout, or you wouldn't ask such as that. We've never had anything to do with folk in Christminster, nor folk in Christminster with we. Jude went out, and, feeling more than ever his existence to be an undemanded one, he lay down upon his back on a heap of litter near the pigsty. The fog had by this time become more translucent, and the position of the sun could be seen through it. He pulled his straw hat over his face, and peered through the interstices of the plating at the white brightness, vaguely reflecting. Growing up brought responsibilities, he found. Events did not rhyme quite as he had thought. Nature's logic was too horrid for him to care for. That mercy towards one set of creatures was cruelty towards another sickened his sense of harmony. As you got older, and felt yourself to be at the center of your time, and not at a point in its circumference, as you had felt when you were little, you were seized with a sort of shuddering, he perceived. All around you there seemed to be something glaring, garish, rattling, and the noises and glares hit upon the little cell called your life, and shook it, and warped it. If he could only prevent himself growing up. He did not want to be a man. Then, like the natural boy, he forgot his despondency, and sprang up. During the remainder of the morning he helped his aunt, and in the afternoon, when there was nothing more to be done, he went into the village. Here he asked a man whereabouts Christminster lay. Christminster? Oh, well, out by there yonder, though I've never been there not one. I've never had any business at such a place. The man pointed northeastward, in the very direction where lay that field in which Jude had so disgraced himself. There was something unpleasant about the coincidence for the moment, but the fearsomeness of this fact rather increased his curiosity about the city. The farmer had said he was never to be seen in that field again, yet Christminster lay across it, and the path was a public one. So, stealing out of the hamlet, he descended into the same hollow which had witnessed his punishment in the morning, never swerving an inch from the path, and climbing up the long and tedious ascent on the other side till the track joined the highway by a little clump of trees. Here the ploughed land ended, and all before him was bleak open down. 3. Not a soul was visible on the edgeless highway, or on either side of it, and the white road seemed to ascend, and diminish till it joined the sky. At the very top it was crossed at right angles by a green edgeway the Icknield Street, and original Roman road through the district. This ancient track ran east and west for many miles, and down almost to within living memory had been used for driving flocks and herds to fairs and markets. But it was now neglected and overgrown. The boy had never before strayed so far north as this from the nestling hamlet in which he had been deposited by the carrier from a railway station southward, one dark evening some few months earlier, and till now he had had no suspicion that such a wide, flat, low-lying country lay so near at hand, under the very verge of his upland world. The whole northern semicircle between east and west, to a distance of 40 or 50 miles, spread itself before him, a bluer, moister atmosphere, evidently, than that he breathed up here. Not far from the road, stood a weather-beaten old barn of reddish-gray brick and tile. It was known as the Brown House by the people of the locality. He was about to pass it, when he perceived a ladder against the eaves, and the reflection, that the higher he got, the further he could see, led Jude to stand and regard it. On the slope of the roof two men were repairing the tiling. He turned into the ridgeway, and drew towards the barn. When he had wistfully watched the workmen for some time he took courage, and ascended the ladder till he stood beside them. "Well, my lad, and what may you want up here?" "I wanted to know where the city of Christminster is, if you please." "Christminster is out across there, by that clump. You can see it at least you can on a clear day." "Ah, no, you can't now." The other tiler, glad of any kind of diversion from the monotony of his labor, had also turned to look towards the quarter designated. "You can't often see it in weather like this," he said. "The time I've noticed it is when the sun is going down in a blaze of flame, and it looks like I don't know what." "The heavenly Jerusalem," suggested the serious urchin. "Eh, though I should never ha' thought of it myself. But I can't see no Christminster today." The boy strained his eyes also, yet neither could he see the far-off city. He descended from the barn, and abandoning Christminster with the versatility of his age he walked along the ridge track, looking for any natural objects of interest that might lie in the banks thereabout. When he repassed the barn, to go back to Mary Green, he observed that the ladder was still in its place, but that the men had finished their day's work and gone away. It was waning towards evening. There was still a faint mist, but it had cleared a little except in the damper tracts of subjacent country and along the river courses. He thought again of Christminster, and wished, since he had come 2 or 3 miles from his aunt's house on purpose, that he could have seen for once this attractive city, of which he had been told. But even if he waited here it was hardly likely that the air would clear before night. Yet he was loth to leave the spot, for the northern expanse became lost to view on retreating towards the village only a few hundred yards. He ascended the ladder, to have one more look at the point the men had designated, and perched himself on the highest rung, overlying the tiles. He might not be able to come so far as this for many days. Perhaps if he prayed, the wish to see Christminster might be forwarded. People said that, if you prayed, things sometimes came to you, even though they sometimes did not. He had read in a tract that a man who had begun to build a church, and had no money to finish it, knelt down and prayed, and the money came in by the next post. Another man tried the same experiment, and the money did not come, but he found afterwards that the breaches he knelt in were made by a wicked Jew. This was not discouraging, and turning on the ladder Jude knelt on the third rung, where, resting against those above it, he prayed that the mist might rise. He then seated himself again, and waited. In the course of 10 or 15 minutes the thinning mist dissolved altogether from the northern horizon, as it had already done elsewhere, and about a quarter of an hour before the time of sunset the westward clouds parted, the sun's position being partially uncovered, and the beams streaming out in visible lines between two bars of slaty cloud. The boy immediately looked back in the old direction. Some way within the limits of the stretch of landscape, points of light like the topaz gleamed. The air increased in transparency with the lapse of minutes, till the topaz points showed themselves to be the vanes, windows, wet roof slates, and other shining spots upon the spires, domes, freestone work, and varied outlines that were faintly revealed. It was Christminster, unquestionably, either directly seen, or miraged in the peculiar atmosphere. The spectator gazed on and on till the windows and vanes lost their shine, going out almost suddenly like extinguished candles. The vague city became veiled in mist. Turning to the west, he saw that the sun had disappeared. The foreground of the scene had grown funereally dark, and near objects put on the hues and shapes of chimeras. He anxiously descended the ladder and started homewards at a run, trying not to think of giants, Herne the hunter, Apollyon lying in wait for Christian, or of the captain with the bleeding hole in his forehead, and the corpses round him that remutinied every night on board the bewitched ship. He knew that he had grown out of belief in these horrors, yet he was glad, when he saw the church tower, and the lights in the cottage windows, even though this was not the home of his birth, and his great aunt did not care much about him. Inside and round about that old woman's hop window, with its 24 little panes set in lead work, the glass of some of them oxidized with age, so that you could hardly see the poor penny articles exhibited within, and forming part of a stock which a strong man could have carried, Jude had his outer being for some long tideless time. But his dreams were as gigantic as his surroundings were small. Through the solid barrier of cold Cretaceous upland to the northward he was always beholding a gorgeous city, the fancied place he had likened to the New Jerusalem, though there was perhaps more of the painter's imagination, and less of the diamond merchant's in his dreams thereof than in those of the apocalyptic writer. And the city acquired a tangibility, a permanence, a hold on his life, mainly from the one nucleus of fact, that the man for whose knowledge and purposes he had so much reverence was actually living there, not only so, but living among the more thoughtful and mentally shining ones there. In sad wet seasons, though he knew it must rain at Christminster too, he could hardly believe that it rained so drearily there. Whenever he could get away from the confines of the hamlet for an hour or two, which was not often, he would steal off to the brown house on the hill and strain his eyes persistently, sometimes to be rewarded by the sight of a dome or spire, at other times by a little smoke, which in his estimate had some of the mysticism of incense. Then the day came when it suddenly occurred to him that, if he ascended to the point of view after dark, or possibly went a mile or two further, he would see the night lights of the city. It would be necessary to come back alone, but even that consideration did not deter him, for he could. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.